work like the devil to earn the vote of the African-American community, not just here, but across the country.
While Mayor Bloomberg was blaming the housing crash of 2008 on African-Americans and on Latinos, in fact, I was out there fighting.
I've started a bank to support black ownership of businesses.
I know that if I were black, my success would have been a lot harder to achieve.
I'm conscious of the fact that there's seven white people on this stage talking about racial justice.
Democratic presidential candidates trying to appeal to black voters during last night's debate. Saturday's South Carolina primary is the first real test for the candidates in a state where the majority of Democratic voters are African American. It was also the last debate before Super Tuesday. We're going to talk about that debate, issues of race, and what matters to black voters now with Michael Harriott, staff writer at The Root and a born and bred South Carolinian. Hi there.
Hi, Madeline. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. So you really followed this debate closely, right? Not only as a political observer, but also as a native South Carolinian. What did you hear last night that really appealed to you?
You know, one of the problems, I think, was that they didn't talk enough about black issues. South Carolina's Democratic Party is about 60% black, which is a big percentage of the voters who are going to participate Saturday. So I thought that we would hear a lot more about the issues that affect those voters. But I was glad to hear that they got into some of the issues, if only it was shallow and kind of a little self-serving for the candidates. But I think the debate last night was, you know, it was almost like a free-for-all. So it was interesting, if nothing else.
Yeah, it was got a little chaotic there in parts. So Joe Biden is considered the favorite in South Carolina, or he was. And I'm wondering how he is trending now in South Carolina among black voters.
I think he's still trending pretty well. I think he's lost a lot of the support. But I think one of the misconceptions was that he lost most of his support. And I warned people, having worked on Obama's campaign in 08 in South Carolina and being a native and having lived in every part of the state, that most of those polls, especially the early polls that they saw, was basically name recognition. So for 12 years, he's been aligned with Obama, who is very popular among South Carolina Democrats and especially South Carolina's black voters. So I don't discount the things that he's fought for on black issues. But I think that if we're being honest, it's because he stood next to Obama for 8 years in the White House.
Well, also, South Carolina Congressman James Clyburn just endorsed him.
But I want the public to know that I'm voting for Joe Biden. South Carolinians should be voting for Joe Biden. I know Joe. We know Joe. But most importantly, Joe knows us.
That's right.
Is that going to carry a lot of weight in South Carolina?
I think so. Clyburn is considered the political kingmaker in South Carolina. I don't even live in Clyburn's district, but you know, he is widely revered throughout the state for his political and his personal positions that he's fought for and held in the black community. So I think it will count for a lot, although I don't know, and I don't even know if you can calculate how much an endorsement weighs on the mind of an average voter when they go into the voting booth.
So in the polls, Tom Steyer, the California billionaire, is polling third in South Carolina. And here is what he had to say last night.
I believe I'm the only person on this stage who believes in reparations for slavery. Something happened. We should have a formal commission on race to retell the story of the last 400 plus years in America of African Americans, of systematic legal injustice, discrimination, and cruelty, but also of 400 plus years of contribution in terms of building the United States of America and leading the United States of America from a moral standpoint.
Let me ask
reparations. And I challenge everyone.
Senator Klobuchar, next question, new topic, new topic.
Okay, so they quickly moved on from reparations last night. Is that a big issue for voters in South Carolina?
I think it is. I think it's a big issue for black voters nationwide. And I think there's a misunderstanding about the idea of reparations. First, we have to acknowledge that in South Carolina, 50% of the enslaved Africans who came to America came through the port that is less than 3 miles from where that debate was held. But it's not just about history. When you talk about reparations, I think the general public sees it as payment of a debt that hasn't been fulfilled. But it is also about economic empowerment and the economic injustices that Black people have suffered through since the beginning of America. And as Black voters and people nationwide become more aware of the wage gap and the income gap and income disparities in the Black communities, they see reparations as a way to fix this, not necessarily as a check that has been due but hasn't been paid, but it would also go a long way to fix some of these economic disparities.
Well, speaking of, Bernie Sanders talks a lot about fixing economic disparities. Is his message resonating with Black voters there?
I think among younger voters, it resonates. We see that in the polls. I hear it when I talk to some of the younger voters. But the voting base of the Democratic Party in South Carolina is a lot older. And if there is any criticism of Bernie Sanders, it is that he couches his economic plans as a rising tide that will lift all boats, and isn't sometimes intentional about saying, I have a plan that is directed specifically to fix the injustices and the disparities in the African-American communities, because he thinks of racism or white supremacy as a math problem instead of a societal issue.
So a math problem in terms of economic disadvantage, that's what you're saying?
Right. And let's be clear, race is inextricably tied to economics, but it is not just tied to economics.
Yeah, and that was a big debate last time around, 4 years ago. Bernie Sanders was really criticized for not getting it, that that economic disparity isn't race blind.
Right. And I think he's taken steps to address that. But some people feel that it's performative and you really don't see it. I'm working now to look at all of the candidates' race plans and you really don't see it in his plans. He's one of the few candidates who doesn't have a specific policy plan that addresses African-Americans specifically.
You started a conversation on Twitter a few days ago where you were talking about a small percentage of Bernie Sanders supporters who are very vocal online, and some of that can be pretty toxic at times. But you said it kind of works. What do you mean by that?
I think it when you look at some of the people who, and they don't necessarily oppose Bernie Sanders, and even the ones that do don't necessarily oppose his policies, right? But there is a small, and I want to always want to be clear that the people we're talking about is a small percentage of passionate Bernie Sanders supporters. And sometimes they go into vitriol and it works to shut down the conversations and the explorations about the criticisms that we just mentioned, right? But it does work because instead of having a Twitter war, most people will say, well, look, I'm just not going to engage because it's not worth the hassle to have this vitriol in your mentions or in your inbox.
So has that affected you and what you write?
I think so, right? I think it's like a puddle that is in your walk. Well, you can jump over it or you can walk around it. And I think that's what most people do. A lot of people just won't deal with it. I don't think it has affected me because I have the privilege of working for a company and an outlet that is run and operated and employs all Black people, right? So I kind of have a privilege that a lot of people who, for instance, don't work for the Washington Post or ABC or a white-owned outlet whose audience is primarily not Black or non-white. Mm-hmm. So it affects me less, but it still affects me.
That's interesting. Well, certainly whenever we do a segment on Bernie Sanders, we do here also get a lot of response, shall
right.
we say.
I can imagine.
Michael Harriott from The Root, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Well, speaking of Bernie Sanders, the Vermont senator went into last night's debate as the front runner. He was hit hard by his fellow Democrats. Joe Biden attacked his record on gun control.
150 million people have been killed since 2007 when Bernie voted to exempt the gun manufacturers from liability. More than all the wars, including Vietnam.
A quick fact check, it's actually 150,000 people. But anyway, Sanders responded.
I have cast thousands of votes, including bad votes.
Well, the Vermont senator has spent nearly three decades in Congress, and at the heart of his campaign is a promise to bring about sweeping change. So how influential has he really been on Capitol Hill? Joining me now to talk about Bernie Sanders' record is Edward Isaac Dover, staff writer at The Atlantic. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. All right. So he has been in Congress for nearly 30 years, as I said. What is his biggest accomplishment?
The biggest overall legislative accomplishment is a Veterans Affairs reform bill that he helped shepherd through as the chair of the Veterans Affairs Committee in 2014. It did a lot to address health and other issues at the VA that, of course, at the time were a huge problem for the Obama administration. And he did it in a way that had bipartisan support. He worked with conservatives in the Senate, with other Democrats. And it was the kind of thing that actually you hear about from days past of the way the Senate used to work. And in that case, it did work. And Sanders, of all people, given that he has been, for the most part, an outsider in Congress and not someone who's been part of deals like that, was the person who was running it. Previous to that, he was known for amendments to an extent, things that he had gotten into some bills. The biggest other accomplishment probably was getting community health care centers into the Obamacare bill, which he did by having a conversation, not really a negotiation, but a deep discussion with Harry Reid, then the Democratic leader in the Senate. But on most of the issues that Bernie Sanders talks about, he has not been able to accomplish almost anything legislatively over the course of his time in Washington.
So his big issue, Medicare for All, for example, he was unable to pass any kind of legislation based on that?
Well, he's introduced a bill, and it has support of people who've signed on to it, and there have been press conferences about it. But that's about it. There is not any real motion towards Medicare for All that that has happened anywhere in the Senate. Now, part of that is because he started really moving on this in the years since the Republicans took the majority in the Senate, which was after the 2014 elections. But it should be said that though there are a number of senators who signed on as co-sponsors of that bill, it's not anywhere near even a majority of the Democratic conference in the Senate. So there's not support for a lot of his ideas, at least as it stands now. He would argue that he has been a thought leader on many of these issues and has pointed the way for where things have moved over the years. It's hard to see the actual causation effect of that. And in some cases, even the correlation is a little bit of a stretch.
Well, what do his colleagues say about that? Even colleagues who support him in terms of him being able to move the needle, maybe not get specific pieces of legislation passed, but change people's thinking so that there is that kind of influence on bills that are passed.
They will speak of him, especially these days as he's been doing better in the presidential race, as someone who has been a real important force in getting ideas out there. They cannot point to many examples of when he has turned those ideas into actual legislative action because there are just not a lot of examples of it.
What about one of his signature issues, and that is taking on the financial industry? He rails a lot against millionaires and billionaires, especially billionaires, and wanting to rein them in. Has he done anything in his nearly three decades in Congress to do that?
Not really. And if you go back to after Obama was elected president and there were the Dodd-Frank reforms that were the most significant reforms passed by Democrats in the last 20, 30 years, Sanders was not really a part of that. He was someone who has been talking about these issues and of the wealth gap and the need to change how society is ordered and the way economics goes for a long time. But when it came to the actual Dodd-Frank bill and the law that eventually Obama signed as president. Bernie Sanders was not part of that. And other people were.
What is his explanation for that?
His explanation is that he was speaking about these issues and helping get people into the right place to think about them differently. But when he was in the House, especially, which is 1991 through 2006, he was really often off on his own island. He was technically caucusing with the Democrats, but they didn't really involve him in these things. When he got to the Senate, which was he was elected in 2006 the first time, he was brought in much more by the leader of the Senate to be part of things. But of course, Dodd-Frank is when he's already in the Senate. And even then, he is not really part of that process. He was often off doing his own thing.
Can you compare him to Senator Elizabeth Warren, who shares many of his beliefs, but has been in power a lot less time?
Right. So Warren is elected for the first time in 2012, which means that she's in the Senate for 6 years less than Sanders, and Sanders had been there in the House all the time previous. She had not been there when Dodd-Frank was passed, but there was a lot of action once, especially the Republicans, were in control of both the Senate and the House, but even when they were just in control of the House, to try to scale back Dodd-Frank. And Warren was very effective in many ways in trying to block those efforts, block them through direct legislative action or through work she was doing from her role as the on the relevant committees by people who were leaders on this issue, including Barney Frank himself, who was a Massachusetts congressman, so has some allegiance to Elizabeth Warren, perhaps. But he spoke to me a couple years ago about how he just was very happy that Elizabeth Warren had been there and could not really put any substance to what Bernie Sanders had done to help protect Dodd-Frank.
There's been some controversy over this news that Bernie Sanders wanted to primary Obama in 2012. He denies that, but you wrote about this. What's the truth there?
Well, Bernie Sanders was speaking publicly about the need for Barack Obama to get a primary challenge to move him to the left. He said it would be the equivalent of what the Tea Party had done for the Republicans. He's talking about this in 2011, so that's right after the Tea Party wave. He was having conversations privately with people that were convincing those people that there needed to be some attention to this and that he was serious about being the primary challenger himself. He was suddenly popping up at events in New Hampshire and speaking critically of Barack Obama and making the rounds in ways that, you know, there's really only one reason why politicians go to New Hampshire, especially in the run-up to an election year. And then it got to the point that the top leadership of the Obama campaign in 2011, going into 2012, asked Harry Reid sit down and talk with Sanders, and they had two conversations. And at the end of them, it reached the point where Sanders said, okay, he wasn't going to actually challenge Obama. The Sanders campaign and Sanders himself insist that none of this is true, that he wasn't at all considering running a primary challenge to Obama. But they have not been able to explain what it is that he was doing if that was not the case.
All right. Edward Isaac Devere, staff writer at The Atlantic, where he writes a lot about Bernie Sanders. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Coming up, we continue our series on the DA candidates here in Los Angeles. Today, George Gascón, former San Francisco DA. He positions himself as the progressive alternative to incumbent Jackie Lacey. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. As we get closer to the March 3rd primary, we're taking another look at the candidates in the L.A. County District Attorney's race. Former San Francisco D.A. George Gascon and former public defender Rachel Rossi are challenging the current D.A., Jackie Lacey. We've already interviewed all three candidates one-on-one, but we wanted to take a closer look at each of their records. Today, we're going to look at Gascon, who left his job in San Francisco to run for office here. He bills himself as a progressive prosecutor who oversaw big reforms in the criminal justice system there. Evan Cernofsky is a reporter at the San Francisco Chronicle. He covered Gascon during his time as DA there, and Evan joins me now. Welcome.
Thanks for having me, Madeline.
Great to have you. Well, how is he a progressive prosecutor? Did he live up to that billing in San Francisco?
Oh, absolutely. George Gascon wasn't only a progressive prosecutor, but he really was one of the first prosecutors to take up this mantle that now we're seeing kind of sweep the country in places like Queens, New York, St. Louis, Boston. All over you see these new progressive prosecutors, but Gascon really was doing this long before it was popular everywhere else, and he came from a law enforcement background, and a lot of people were apprehensive, especially progressives here in the city, about what kind of law enforcement official he would be, and ultimately surprised a lot of people early on when he started advocating and co-sponsoring these sweeping legislative reforms like AB 109, Prop 47, things that really started reducing the state prison population and treating certain crimes a lot differently, especially crimes related to drug offenses.
Well, can you outline the progressive reforms that he brought to office as DA in San Francisco?
Sure. The major reforms that he brought were AB 109, which is known as realignment, which allowed inmates in state prison to serve their time locally in local jails. It helped dramatically reduce the state prison population. He co-sponsored Prop 47, which reduced certain felonies to misdemeanors in cases of theft and drug possession. Locally, he expunged all marijuana cases. I know Jackie Lacey, I think, last week announced a similar program. Gascon did that here in San Francisco last year. He started using the Arnold tool, which is a public safety assessment tool, which largely was a major step in doing away with the cash bail system in San Francisco. And the Arnold tool is actually one of the public safety tools that SB 10 requires as far as determining whether or not a person is eligible for release without bail.
Well, let's talk in particular about Prop 47, because he's gotten a lot of pushback on that from the police, for one, and some other groups. And so here's what he said when I asked him about that.
It has reduced crime in some areas, but let's also look at the crimes that are not covered, right? Robbery, by the way, robbery has not gone up, but robberies are not covered by Prop 47. Burglaries are not covered by Prop 47. Car break-ins are not covered by Prop 47. So if those things went up, don't blame it in Prop 47. Blame it in something else, but not Prop 47.
Okay, is that accurate?
Right. So it's specific that we take a look at Prop 47 and look at specifically what it does. And what it does is it reduces felonies for certain kinds of crimes to misdemeanors. And those crimes are two categories specifically. They're thefts under $950, and they're drug possession charges. So the cops, police unions, law enforcement groups around California fought Prop 47 before it was ever made the law, solely associating low-level drug offenses and theft cases. It's certainly possible that other crimes have gone up as a result of that, but there's no real direct correlation. You can't draw a line and go, oh, well, more people who are released for low-level drug crimes are causing burglaries to go up. It doesn't really make sense as a straight line. There's a lot of theories around, you know, increased sort of sense of lawlessness, perhaps, that may some people attribute to these increases. But there's no real thing built into Prop 47 itself that you can say caused these other crimes to go up.
Right. Although if you are not prosecuting a theft under $950 as a felony, then do the police even bother arresting anyone or investigating a crime if it's not a felony?
Well, this is another issue that we saw in San Francisco, which particularly around auto burglaries. Our police chief at the time, Greg Sir, was really came out against Prop 47 and had a top-down messaging that we're not even going to go out and investigate some of these things. And I talked to dozens and dozens of people. Anytime their car was broken into, they would call up a local station and they would get this sort of apathetic response that said, well, there's nothing we can do about it. Prop 47. Guess what happened? Auto burglaries went through the roof. Since then, we have a new police chief who's made it a huge priority to bring officers out, to bring fingerprinting kits out. And since then, auto burglaries have gone down 17% in the last 2 years.
It might be kind of confusing to people to think of a San Francisco DA having such a major role in state legislation. How does that work?
Yeah, I mean, he has his policy team, which has been almost as robust and active as his prosecuting side. And part of his philosophy has been if we don't like the laws around our criminal justice system, that we should change them. I mean, he has had a robust and relentless program to change California's laws around criminal justice reform.
And let's talk about his record on prosecuting police misconduct and police brutality and officer-involved
sure.
shootings. I guess some people on the left, even to the left of him, are angry with him for not prosecuting a pair of police officers involved in two controversial shootings. Can you tell us about that?
Right. So when Gascon left, he really didn't have a lot of friends on either side of the political aisle. On the right, he had a lot of frustration from the police union and the rank-and-file officers, as well as the moderates in City Hall like London Breed. And he was also the target of a lot of frustration from the progressive activist groups who were really only focused on this one issue, which was prosecuting the officers in two high-profile police killings. They demanded he prosecute these cops, and Gascon said, we don't see under the law as it's written that we can prosecute this and get a guilty verdict in it. He did, however, when he announced that he wasn't prosecuting the officers, advocate for a change in the law, saying that we needed to change the standard by which officers can use deadly force. That change has led to AB 392, which changes the standard of police use of force.
So he left office, as you say, not pleasing either side. Who are his fans in San Francisco?
Well, his fans, I think the best way to describe his base would be like moderate Democrats who believe in criminal justice reform and know his record and understand what he's done has really been on the vanguard of criminal justice reform around the country, and especially in California.
Well, I want to thank you so much.
Sure.
That's Evan Cernofsky. He covered George Gascon for the San Francisco Chronicle. George Gascon, one of the candidates for L.A. County D.A. Coming up, after you die, why not compost your body?
Your microbes and your atoms and everything in your body completely transforms during the process. And you are no longer human at all. You literally become the soil.
A new bill would allow that to happen here in California. That story is next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, after you die, there are basically two options for what happens to your body, burial or cremation. A new bill here in California wants to reimagine your afterlife plan by turning you into soil. This is called human composting. And the company leading the charge for this is called Recompose. They say for every person whose body composts rather than being cremated or buried, a metric ton of carbon is saved from entering the environment. It involves taking a corpse and allowing natural microbes to break down the body, turning the remains into nutrient-rich soil. Here to tell us more about this is Caitlin Doty. She's a Los Angeles-based mortician and death theorist. Welcome back.
Thank you for having me back. It's an exciting time to be in death.
Well, yeah. So clarify this process. How does it work, this body composting process?
It's very similar to what would happen in normal human decomposition in the soil. It's just an accelerated version. So we all know that burial space can cost quite a lot of money, especially in a city like Los Angeles. And the idea behind Recompose or human composting is having a center where families could come and the process of decomposing the body would just be sped up a little bit and brought down to natural soil, which could then be used to potentially grow things and grow a tree or grow a bush. It's very popular to think about becoming a tree now because I think it really speaks to our fears of climate change and our desire to become more a part of the natural world. If those are your values in life, I think a process like composting or recompose can really reflect that then in your death.
So people might have a visceral reaction to this and think, wow, that sounds kind of ugh and disrespectful of the human body, that we're not just a bunch of, you know, vegetable scraps in the compost pile.
Here's what I say to that. First of all, it absolutely depends on your point of view whether or not you think this is the most magical news you've ever heard. Decomposition and death is always a little messy. Cremation is burning a dead human body. Mm-hmm. Embalming is putting chemicals, cancer-causing chemicals, into the human body. Alkaline hydrolysis, which was just legalized 2 years ago in Los Angeles, is putting potassium hydroxide and high-heat water to dissolve a human body. Every method that we currently have to do something with the dead human body, where something must be done, has an element of the brutal to it if you choose to make that the sensationalist headline.
Okay, so walk us through what would happen, like if you were interested in it, and someone you know dies and that person wants to be composted, then what happens?
Right. I think Katrina Spade, who designed this method, has actually given so much thought the idea of modern rituals and mourning and the way that we mourn now in the 21st century. And the idea is to have these buildings, these centers, they're constructing one now in Seattle, where it was legalized last year. And it would be a place where you would come and the family would be very much involved with this process. They would come, they would be able to sit with the body, be with the body, make some final ritual, you know, help wrap up the body, maybe even put them in to the wood chips, pour some water on top, just feeling like they are very much a part of this ritual and the part of this end of life. And then it would be a certain amount of time and maybe a month, maybe a little bit longer, and then they would be able to come back. And either the soil could go to places that they have set up for soil to go, like forests that were pre-designated, or you could take a symbolic amount back to your own garden if that's meaningful to you.
Yeah, it would be quite something to see a tree growing and you can look out your window and see that tree and think, well, part of that tree is, you know, my
loved
one. Absolutely.
Yeah, it's mom. And to be clear, the way that they treat the compost that comes at the end of this process is the same way that you would treat cremated remains, in the sense that it is not human remains. We're not talking about pieces of mom in the compost. The thing that really interested me about this process from the very beginning years ago was the idea that your microbes and your atoms and everything in your body completely transforms during the process. And you are no longer human at all. You literally become the soil. You're no longer just mom in some soil. You become the soil. So it would be totally safe and totally legal if this bill passes to have some of that soil because it's not mom, the same way that your cremated remains are inorganic material. Mm-hmm. They're not mom.
So it's going to take a while before this is passed, if it is passed and becomes law. Is there anything to do in the meantime that is environmentally conscious?
Yeah, there's lots of options. Green burial is a fantastic option, which is just the body being put straight into the earth. And in many ways, what we're talking about with composting is what would happen in green burial. It would just take a little bit longer and you wouldn't get any of the soil back after the process. It would be a grave that stays there forever. There's also the option of pretty soon, hopefully, aquamation or alkaline hydrolysis, which is finally, it was passed 2 years ago, but it's just now becoming legal this year in California, which again is high heat water that dissolves the body, which is an alternative to cremation. And just be open-minded and interested. As I said, it's an interesting time to be in death. We have these new options, and we're finally getting options for people who are more environmentally minded, who want something different for themselves, who want something less expensive than perhaps the traditional funeral industry has been offering them. And they're finally being heard. And a bill like this is really exciting for that reason.
Well, Caitlin, thank you.
Thank you so much.
That's Caitlin Doty. She's a Los Angeles-based mortician and death theorist. Boy, does our director have a sense of humor. Coming up, Elevating the Lowly Bean, a whole cookbook devoted to cooking beans, even as dessert. Next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Think of a plate of beans and your mind might wander back to that childhood rhyme. You know the one. Beans, beans, the musical fruit, the more you eat. Okay, you know it. I only bring that up to say that beans really don't have the best reputation, and it's just not just. It's not right. Beans are cheap, after all. They're filling. They're full of protein. They're relatively easy on the environment, and they're a staple in tons of cuisines around the world. Well, Joe Yonan is the food and dining editor at The Washington Post, and he's pretty much a bean evangelist. He has a new cookbook out about the joy of cooking with beans for every meal, from appetizers to desserts. It's called, appropriately, Cool Beans. Hi there.
Hey, Madeline. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. When did you fall in love with the bean?
Oh, man. Man, the first sighting, you mean?
Yeah.
Let's see. well, you know, I grew up in West Texas, and so I grew up eating Tex-Mex food and Mexican food, and I think I fell in love with probably the first bean I had, which would have definitely been a side of beans and rice on the side of some enchiladas, probably at a Tex-Mex restaurant. Yeah. I mean, my mom made beans, certainly. She was from the Midwest, and she certainly worked beans into some dishes. One of her favorite things to make was something that she called Texas salad, which some people called taco salad, which was basically iceberg lettuce and red kidney beans and cheddar cheese and a bag of Fritos crushed up and a bottle of Catalina French style dressing.
Wow.
That's overdressing the whole thing.
That is an extravaganza.
It was intense. Yeah. Yeah.
So are you sure you didn't fall in love with that dressing rather than the beans?
it was pretty good.
But beans do have a kind of dowdy reputation, let's admit.
Yeah.
Why is that?
Yeah, they do. They do. Well, I think for a lot of people, they might be really associating beans with poverty, which is certainly true. You know, beans are so cheap and affordable to make. They are the basis of a lot of cuisines around the world, and they certainly do, you know, help you put a nutritious meal on the table for not very much money. But I think that we in America tend to really venerate culinary traditions that come from maybe some more elegant backgrounds. And it's only been, I think, recent that we've really paid attention to the influence of all the wonderful immigrant foods in this country. And beans are certainly part of that.
Well, could it also be that with beans, they don't really have a distinctive taste in the sense that, I don't know.
I might argue with you about that.
I mean, a lot of, okay, I know you well, and you're probably right, because you know how to cook them. I would argue that a lot of the beans' deliciousness comes from the surrounding, the supporting players, the sauce, for example.
But I would say that you can make that sauce just from using water and some very simple aromatic vegetables and cooking them from dried with enough salt.
Mm. there is a little bit of controversy over how to treat beans before you do all the cooking of them and adding in the sauces and all that. So, first question, if you have time, soak or don't bother?
You don't have to soak. Here's my thing about soaking. You don't have to soak, and that's the message that I really want people to get. You really don't have to. But there are reasons why you might want to soak. If you have a particularly difficult time with the gas from beans, you talked about the musical fruit, You might want to soak your beans because it will certainly lessen those effects. There's also the biggest reason that I would soak beans would be if I'm not sure how old they are. I feel like soaking is a little bit of an insurance policy. If I'm not sure how old a bean is, and, you know, when you buy them in the supermarket, you really aren't sure. So then if I have time, I will soak them. But even when I do that, I usually soak them in a saltwater solution. So it's kind of another reason not to worry too much about soaking them.
Well, speaking of salt, I had always heard that you don't salt your beans until the end when you're cooking them because it makes them hard. Not true?
Yeah, not really true. There's a small time difference from all the research that I did. There's a very small time difference. It'll extend the cooking by a little bit. But I think the trade-off is that you end up with a really flavorful pot of beans if you add the salt at the beginning or salt them when you're soaking them.
You're not afraid of over-salting?
No. You really get this cooking liquid when you cook a pot of beans that way that I think rivals the best chicken stocks.
Wow.
And much easier to make. It's the main reason why I encourage so many people to cook beans from dried. I mean, don't get me wrong. I think that canned beans are one of the world's great convenience products, and I use them plenty. But there's no comparison in flavor between canned beans that you've rinsed because you don't want all that goop all over them and beans that you've cooked from dried, especially if they're from a reasonably good source.
By the way, what is all that goop on canned beans?
It's certainly usually got a lot of sodium in it, unless they're no salt added beans. It's definitely
slimy.
The product of cooking them. It's kind of
gross.
Slimy,
yeah.
And it's kind of gross. I mean, the one exception I would say is with chickpeas. Where that cooking liquid, especially the liquid in the can, is anything but gross. It's actually kind of magical. Have you noticed any recipes for what's called aquafaba lately?
I have not, except in your book. And I was going to ask you about that because I don't know what that means.
Yeah, well, a French vegan pastry chef, if I've got this right, I don't know, maybe about 7 or 8 years ago, was trying to come up with a substitute for egg whites. And he was thinking about things that might possibly do the trick, and he had some canned chickpeas on him, and he was draining them, and he thought, you know, that liquid reminds me of the viscosity of egg whites. I wonder what would happen if I tried to whip them up. And he whipped them up, and guess what happened? They whipped up just like egg whites. He added sugar. They became glossy. You can make a meringue out of them. You can make pavlova. You can do all sorts of things with it. So that's the one exception. I actually love that liquid.
Okay, well, speaking of chickpeas, let's get straight to the hummus.
Okay.
You have a hummus recipe in here.
I have, I believe, multiple hummi.
Multiple. Let's talk about like the basic fluffy recipe.
Yeah.
The one that you could use for almost everything.
Right.
So why this out of the gazillions of different variations of hummus recipes out there? Did you go with this particular recipe?
Well, it's the one that I make more often than any other. It's the one that I don't even, you know, I've got committed to memory that I just go and do at the Vitamix, which is, you know, a couple of cans of chickpeas or a large can of chickpeas that you've drained but not rinsed. You've reserved the liquid. And the key really to me with this is to use a Vitamix or another high-powered blender. You can certainly do it in a food processor and it works just fine. But if you use a Vitamix, it's going to get particularly fluffy and light. And so you first puree the chickpeas, the tahini, the garlic, the lemon juice, and a little bit of the aquafaba. And then while the motor's running, you slowly pour in another half a cup of that aquafaba. And it emulsifies. And it ends up being I tell people to stop when it's about the texture of a thick pancake batter, which might seem thin to people who are used to these store-bought hummuses where, you know, you could really put up some wallpaper with them.
Yeah.
But once you try it like this and you swoosh it on a plate and you drizzle it with some excellent olive oil and you sprinkle it with, you know, I like smoked paprika or za'atar or sumac, and you swipe your crudité or your pita chips or your pita or whatever you want through the hummus, you will realize that that is the texture that you always want your hummus to be forever and ever. Amen.
Yeah, I mean, who likes to eat wallpaper paste anyway?
Right.
Okay, so you also begin the book with a trip to Mexico in search of these beans and this fabled dish. And then you're able to reprint the recipe in this book. Yeah. Lalo's Cacahuate Beans.
Yes.
Can you talk about that? Because another funny anecdote in there is that you just missed the last serving when you arrived because Jessica Coslow, Squirrel, had taken it all.
Man, right?
She got
the
there
funny
before
thing
you.
About that is, yeah. So the funny thing to me about that, among other things, is, yeah, I'm talking to the chef, Eduardo Garcia, whose nickname is Lalo. And, you know, he's so articulate. He has this amazing story, and he's talking about his own background and about Mexican-U.S. trade policy and about how he thinks NAFTA has really, you know, compromised a lot of Mexico's ability to really uplift its own culinary culture. Now, I had heard that he makes this, you know, really great pot of beans, and so I'm asking about them. He's talking about this particular variety called cacahuate that I didn't know. Cacahuate means peanut, so they're named for the way that the bean looks when it's raw. And he's going on and on and on, and this is about an hour before we're going to sit down for dinner, and then he drops the news on me that, you know, he happens to be out of them. And he said, yeah, some chef from L.A. was visiting, and, you know, I was telling her this story, and she convinced me to give her all the beans, and I just knew. I knew. And I said, it was Jessica Coslow, was it not? And he was very surprised that I would know such a thing. And I said, yeah, well, we bean obsessives tend to know who each other are. So thankfully, he was getting another shipment in within a few days. And so I went back. My husband and I went back to the restaurant a few days later. It's a tasting menu only restaurant. But when we came back, we had already done the whole tasting menu. So when we came back, you know, we told the waiter, we're actually just getting the beans. And the waiter looked at us like we were crazy. But it was worth the wait.
Yum. Sounds like it's worth the wait. And then the recipe's here in your book. So
yeah. Yeah. It's such an interesting recipe they're actually very simple to do at home. But I found the recipe so interesting because I've never really cooked beans this way. He basically cooks them very simply, you know, with just a little garlic. And then he makes a sofrito, you know, with tomatoes and chilies. And then he puts that back in the pot of beans, turns up the heat, and you boil them for about 30 minutes, which to me when I first made it, I was thinking to myself, this is such a rough way to treat these beans. You know, it seemed really rough. I'm used to this gentle cooking. And what it did, of course, was it just concentrated that liquid and just made that flavor just completely take over the whole bowl of beans. And then you serve them with a simple pico de gallo.
Yum. That sounds delicious.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, and the other thing that I'll mention about those beans is that while I was eating them, I was thinking ahead to how I was going to, how I would interpret this for the home cook. You know, what bean am I going to tell people? I'm not going to tell people that they have to find these rare cacahuate beans from this little village in Mexico. And then when the beans came, I thought, oh, you know, these remind me of cranberry beans, which are also borlotti beans. And I thought, I'll try this with those beans when I get home. And then I started Googling around, and it turns out that cacahuate and cranberry and borlotti beans are just three different names for the exact same bean.
Okay, and finally, dessert. What's a very quick idea for dessert?
So I really love red beans in desserts. You know, it has this tradition of Asian cooking behind it, you know, red bean paste, red bean ice cream. I have a red bean ice cream in the book, but I used little red beans, they're azuki beans, in this chocolate brownie that I also combine rose water and a little bit of like pistachios and rose petals on top when you cook them. And they're absolutely delicious, and they don't taste like beans.
Joe Yonan, he's the food and dining editor at The Washington Post. His new cookbook, it's all about beans, is called Cool Beans. Joe, thank you.
Thanks so much for having me, Madeline. It was a blast.
Okay, Michelle Alloy, you conducted a Twitter poll based on that interview, and...
I did. There was some fierce debate. Beans, beans, the blank fruit. Is it musical or magical? 55% said magical, 43% said musical. The 55% are wrong.
It is definitely musical.
Magical makes no sense.
Makes absolutely no sense. Okay. Fake news. Hanging chads.
Fake news. Musical fruit.
All right, Michelle, thank you. Thanks for listening. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.